And welcome back to Anger, Sadness, and Envy, the official podcast of Bungie fan site Rampancy.net. I'm Narcogen, webmaster of Rampancy.
And I'm Trindicup.
And this is episode number 4, and we'll be talking about the fourth level of Halo 3 called The Storm. But before we get right in on the level of The Storm, we're just going to relate some updates sent to us by Bungie fan Cody Miller. A couple of episodes ago, we talked about how the Master Chief doesn't speak too much and wondered whether or not he was quieter in Halo 3 than he was in some of the other games. We said that, well, if we had some spare time, maybe we'd go and play all the games and count the words. Well, we didn't have that much spare time, but Cody did. And so he sent us the totals, and here are the totals for each of the three Halo games. In Halo 1, the Master Chief spoke 158 words. In Halo 2, only 113 words. And in Halo 3, 155 words. So Halo 1 and Halo 3, just about the same, only three words different. And both games have 9 levels. Halo 2, total is way down, but that's understandable because you're playing as the Arbiter for several of those levels. So if you work it out by levels, in Halo 1, 9 levels, 158 words, so that's 17.5 words average per level. In Halo 2, there are 7 levels that the Chief is the main character, and for 113 words, that's 16.1 words per level. So even though you play the Chief less often in Halo 2, he's still speaking, on average, less per level. Now, of course, the Chief never speaks during a level during gameplay. These are all during the cutscenes, but usually every level has at least one cutscene attached to it. You know, there one that begins the level or one that ends the level. Sometimes there's just one that goes between two levels, and sometimes there's two. There's a closing cutscene for the previous level, and then there's an opening cutscene for the next level. And in Halo 3, back up to 9 levels, 155 words, so that's 17.2 words per level. So very, very slight difference. I mean, it's really, really consistent throughout the whole series. Maybe the only difference is that, as we've mentioned before, Halo 3 is much more sparing with its use of cutscenes, and the Chief doesn't speak outside the cutscene. We just talked about Savo Highway, and as we were talking before the podcast started, the Chief doesn't seem to speak in that level at all. And again, maybe it was because they intended to use this as a level where they were going to promote it to the press. They were going to let people see it before the game was ready. And so there are no, there's no intro cutscene. The closing cutscene is very short, and the Chief doesn't say anything. And there's hardly any story elements in it at all. And to bring us into the storm, we kind of see the same thing here. There's no opening cutscene for the storm. It's just another scripted sequence. You start off the level and you're riding in the passenger seat of a warthog. You can't get out until the sequence is done, but you can look around. So you have camera control and you listen to the voiceover that's gonna tell you what you're supposed to be doing. Just like in Savo Highway, you start in a scripted sequence where there's dialogue going on that sets the scene for you, but they don't take camera control away.
And much like we mentioned before this as well, is so far we haven't had any real story. What we're doing now is really the beginning of the story, where we've got an objective, and it's for a forward movement, not just to get back up to where we were.
Yeah, the only hint of this of the real story of what's going to happen really starts in the opening cutscene of Crow's Nest, right? Because we have Truth who comes in and threatens everybody, and then Hood develops this plan where he says, "Okay, Truth's ship is protected by anti-aircraft batteries. You have to knock one out so that the human ships can go in and do attack." So everything so far in the game is leading up to that, is in preparation for that. Basically, it's just the Chief getting into position for that. You know, he's found in the jungle, he meets up at the base is attacked, he escapes. And now we're getting close to the ultimate objective in terms of, attacking the Covenant comes at the end of this level where you're supposed to assault this AA gun. and the story doesn't really start until that happens. Everything that is just, okay, Chief, get from here to there, and some side missions, you know, the usual things, you know, rescuing Marines and that sort of stuff. So let me just ask you this first. I mean, do you think this is a good idea? I mean, there are people who argue about this, the idea of a scripted sequence. There are people who say that, you know, a cutscene is far too traditional. Games shouldn't try to be movies. They shouldn't take away your control. And there are those who say that, you know, scripted sequences don't work because they don't point out what the player, you know, needs to pay attention to.
I mean, scripted gameplay can, in a way, it can be frustrating. You know, you've got limited, it's just limited movement. There's no real sort of epic feeling towards it. At the start of the level, I think I'd rather drive in, watch the Warthog drive in, rather than sit in there looking around without anything to do. Cutscenes from the perspective of the player, who could almost feel like they're Master Chief, you know, they're sitting in there, they're holding the controller, they are the Master Chief. Being in that cutscene is much the same as being in a scripted gameplay, because in both scenarios you have little or no control, except cinematics make it look a lot better.
Yeah, I don't know that I mind them so much. I do know that some of the criticisms of the scripted events, say the Half-Life 2 events, is similar to what goes on here. So for instance, you start out, you're in this hog, you have camera control, but you can't get out. You know, there's nothing you can do. You're not driving. You can't get out of the hog until the sequence ends. And some people, I guess, would find that annoying. They say, well, I don't care what Bungie wants to show me. If you want to show me a cutscene, fine. I'll either watch it or I'll skip it. But a scripted sequence, in some ways, is a little bit worse of both. You can't skip it. You can't do anything. And it's also not as, storytelling-wise, it's not as deep or as dense as an actual cutscene. I know that some people who didn't like that technique in Half-Life 2... they thought it was a little bit ridiculous. So, for instance, in Half-Life 2, you go into the laboratory, and there are scripted events that happen there where characters interact with each other, and you have full camera control. You can either do what they say and pay attention to them as they act out their little scripts, or you can ignore it. And some people say, yeah, but this is a little bit silly, because now you can go nuts. You can do anything you want in that environment. You can break stuff, throw things around the room, hop up on the table. And because the characters aren't scripted to respond to you in that way, they just keep following their pre-described scripts. They don't, you know, they don't do anything different based on what you do. They don't react. And they said, well, this kind of breaks the immersion in the game, you know, that these characters don't react in a realistic way. So I suppose I can see that. Now, there aren't really any sequences like that in Halo. I mean, they limit your actions so that you're not allowed to do those things. So, for instance, this opening sequence where you're driving in the Warthog, you can't, you know, jump out, get in front of the hog, get run over, kill yourself, blow up the hog. But
one, you can't shoot.
Yeah, and you can't shoot. And there's nothing to shoot at, really. I mean, you could shoot the other hog. Of course, now, once you get out of the hog and you have full control, you can immediately start to mess with things, which, of course, is what I did when the level finally did start. You roll up to the door there, and they say, okay, you go in, clear out the Covenant, we'll cover you with the gun. So, of course, the first thing it occurred to me to do was, well, what'll they say if I get rid of the gun? So, you know, I took the hog with the mounted gun, and I drove it off a cliff, and I walked back up to the door, and they say the same thing. They say, we're going to cover you with the 50, and I'm like, yeah, like hell you are, because there isn't one anymore.
I said that's a very valid point. It's not scripted gameplay, I guess. Or is it? Would you call that the scripted gameplay? I mean, they're going to be following a specific path. They've got their orders.
Well,
have to go in there and open a door up and let them in, and they'll obliterate whatever's in there.
Well,
until they get stuck with a couple of sticky grenades.
I don't think they would call that scripted in the same way things that, for instance, like in CR-117, when you come across the brute who is torturing a Marine. You know, that's what I would consider a scripted, you know, a bit of scripted gameplay, as opposed to just a scripted event like the one that opens this level. Now, having said that, there's obviously, I think, a way that Bungie expects the player to go through certain, you know, certain of these encounters. So, for instance, they expect that what you're going to do is, you know, you're going to go around the side and you're going to sneak in and you're going to hit the button and open the door, and then the Marines will drive the Warthog in. But of course, you don't have to play it that way if you want. For instance, you can not open that door, and you can advance to the next area and clean them out. And in fact, I prefer to do that, though, because the first thing that happens, if you go in and open that first door and the Marines drive the Warthog in through that door into the second room, it's a really good chance that a grunt is going to tag that Warthog with a grenade and you're going to lose it. So if you want to keep that Warthog, and you can also bring the troop Warthog, you can also bring in. In fact, if you get rid of the lag hog, you can get them to go in the troop hog, and you can bring that in. So I prefer to go
another
to the
thing, another valuable aspect of being able to keep that door shut is just metascore. When you try and get a high score,
sure,
metascore on that level,
sure, you want
to the best way to do it. Sorry?
Sure, you want to stop the Marines from stealing your kills.
And you can do that throughout most of the level, too. I mean, when it comes to the Scarab, if you take both of the mounted rockets, it's a little bit tedious, but if you take both of the mounted rockets and drop them somewhere, if you take out the gunner of each of the Mongoose, it slows them down considerably. You can get out there usually and take care of both of those tanks first. More importantly, that particularly that part, when it comes to metascore, you just take the rockets from the people and the Mongoose. You don't actually drive out there with the passenger. You don't get as many points.
True, but there's another way to do that. You're right. I mean, if you're talking about the metascore, one way of maximizing your score is to minimize the number of enemy targets that are taken out by somebody other than you. Another way to do that, though, is to try to use those marine resources to maximize the amount of score you get. So, for instance, if you're driving, you get points, you get splatter points for things you drive over, but you also get the kills for that are made by your passengers. So what I usually try to do, and we'll get to that, or I guess we're coming to that already, is that if you can get a troop hog all the way to the portion where you're supposed to get on a mongoose, it's really really tedious. But if you beat on the mongooses to flip them, the driver and the passenger will get out, and if you then get in the driver's seat of a troop hog before the mongoose driver flips the mongoose back over, the Marines will get in the troop hog with you. So you can...
And they'll have rockets.
Yeah, and they'll have rockets.
Potentially have three... Would you have three... Hold three or four? Three or five.
There's four, because there's five passengers total, including the driver. So you've got a guy in the seat next to you, and then three in the back. Basically, one on each side, and then one guy who's facing back. So you can have four rocket launchers. Now, sometimes it's a lot of fun, and sometimes it's not. And I think that's just something that you can say about all of the vehicle encounters. Like, when the vehicle encounters work the way you want them to, or work the way they're supposed to, they're more fun than playing the game just from an infantry perspective, you know, as a normal shooter. But when they don't work, the experience is a lot less fun. So, you know, and if you exaggerate the encounters by loading up the hog full of rocket troops, you know, that does the same thing. You know, when you drive through and they don't miss any shots and you don't get blown up, it's a lot more fun. But when you drive right up to a wall and they shoot directly into it and blow you across, you know, it can be a lot more frustrating. But again, just to rewind a little bit, to go back to the first doors, if you don't open that first door, you can wait till you get to the second, because at the end of that hall, obviously, there are two ghosts. You can actually go through that, and the Marines won't follow you until you open the second door. When you open the second door, the first one also opens. But you can, you know, block them from coming in there, or you can run ahead fast enough that you can take those ghosts out. So it's possible to have two hogs with you. You know, they'll drive one, and you can bring the other one in and then get them to go into it. But unfortunately, just like in Salvo Highway, sometimes they'll seemingly ignore a Warthog, especially if it's the second one. So if you want to use the troop hog in the mongoose sequence, the easiest way seems to be to get rid of the warthog with the lag gun at the beginning of that level, or use the second troop hog, actually, because when you come to the end of this sequence and open that first outer door to go into the second outdoor area, just down below the ramp, there's another crashed troop hog. It's damaged, but it's workable. And the Marines seem to prefer that one. I don't know why. If you give them a choice, there are some troop hogs that, like, you get in and drive and they won't react at all. And then you get out, get into another one, and they'll immediately run to get in that one. I don't know why.
So moving on before we see the Scarab, which we'll get through in a moment, we also...
Yeah.
We determine the fate of a race we hadn't yet seen, the Hunters, who obviously sided with the Brutes.
Oh, back up. No, the Hunters are after the Scarab, but before the AA gun.
Oh, they are.
But in this first outdoor area, the big thing is the Catch Skull.
Oh, the Catch Skull. My favorite.
So how did you go about getting the Catch Skull?
I just pushed a ghost up. Pushed a ghost up and jumped on the side. There's a elevated side there that I used to get up there with the ghost. Yourself?
There's an elevator in there?
No, like an elevated mob.
Oh, yeah. I had a lot of trouble getting that. I mean, I did read, once I knew where it was, I read some instructions that said you can just grenade jump on there. And I'm just terrible at grenade jumping, so that was no good. I actually made up a huge pile of vehicles, I think like 3 or 4 ghosts on top of a hog at the very back. And meanwhile, of course, the Wraith is firing at that area, and every once in a while the pile would blow away. And I found it kind of frustrating because I mean I realized it should have been easier than that. I figured that once I had triggered it and knew where it was, that I ought to be able to get at it. But I had a tough time. I mean,
I still don't quite understand the trigger for it. I must admit, I've read about it and I still don't quite get it.
I don't know. It seems fairly clear to me what the trigger is that gets rid of it. For instance, I have people say that if you take out that second Wraith, that it will despawn. And in saved films of my games that I've looked at, that's true. If you take that Wraith out, then it disappears. What was, I think, more unclear to people is what actually causes it to spawn, because there are people who've said that, look, you know, all you're supposed to do is you open that door and come out into that area, and some people say, well, it's there, and some people not. I think there may be a trigger volume for that skull somewhere kind of in front of the pier, between where you come out, you know, where you enter that outdoor area, and where the skull is itself. I think if you run all the way around to the left, so for instance, if you stay on the raised area, the pier, you know, and go around to the little room that's held by the Covenant,
yep.
I think it's possible that if you stay in that area, that the skull will never spawn, because the trigger of it, I think, is on the ground. What I noticed, though, is that if I open that door and I just run straight out and jump off the pier, down onto the ground, and run directly for where the skull will be, that after you've taken a few steps on the ground to that next pier, that's what seems to trigger it. Now, I think if in any time during the fight you go near that area, you know, if you take a hog down to the ground and you're driving around or you're fighting with ghosts or doing anything in that area, I think that's what triggers it. But I think if you stay to the left, you know, you could stay to the left-hand side and go straight for the exit to that area towards the door, I think you might not trigger it. And then, of course, if you attack, you know, if you trigger the second Wraith that comes in and you fight the Wraith, then it'll never spawn. You know, it won't ever have come into the game, and it won't spawn once you've killed that Wraith. That's just a theory.
I mean, there's the Fog Skull as well, but that's the only other spawning skull apart from I Would Have Been Your Daddy.
I think that might be right. I think all the other skulls, I think, spawn... that are triggered by player movement into an area. So, like, once you hit a checkpoint or something like that, you know, a normal event. I don't know that this one is supposed to be special. I think it's supposed to be triggered by fighting in that area. I think maybe there's just a hole in the trigger volume so that if you go around one side and never fight in that area, that it's never triggered. I'm not sure. Fog, of course, yeah, is similar. You have to do something special to trigger it, and that's in the next level, Floodgate. When we get to that level, we'll talk about it. Now, the other thing you can do, of course, in this area is that you start off with vehicles at the beginning of the level, and you're in an outdoor area. You can bring those vehicles with you through the short indoor area that ends and open up a door that comes out to this area that has the ship and has the two wraiths. And, of course, you can bring those vehicles. And there are other vehicles there. There are ghosts, and there is a troop hog down there. And you can bring those vehicles with you into the next indoor area because that door doesn't have any invisible barrier on it. And, of course, that's that second indoor area, you know, where you fight some more brutes and grunts, and there are some drones and a turret. It's that next outdoor area just before you get to that has the mongooses. The mongooses with all the rockets. Now, playing this area, I can sort of understand where Bungie was coming from when they cut the mongoose from the first game. When you look at your options here, we talked, for instance, about Savo Highway, about how many options you have when you start that level because of the variety of vehicles. You know, because you've got two vehicles with you, and one has a gun and one doesn't. There are a lot of, you know, you have about six different ways to approach that. When you come to this vehicle encounter, though, your choices are much more limited and a lot less attractive. So, for instance, the mongoose doesn't have any built-in weapon. So your only choices here are, well, you can drive the mongoose or you can ride on it. And there are two ammo machines nearby that have rockets and rocket launchers. But of course, since the game treats you differently than the AI NPCs, if you were to grab a rocket launcher and get onto the back of the warthog, onto the back of the mongoose, excuse me, you know, your ammunition is going to run out pretty soon. You're not, except on the lower difficulty levels, you're not going to be able to bring down a scarab with just the rockets in that rocket launcher. And probably the best you're going to have for another weapon would be, you know, an assault rifle or a battle rifle. And those aren't really effective weapons against vehicles. So riding the mongoose, at least, you know, it's only a temporary option. I mean, if you get on there with a rocket launcher, you're probably not even going to make it to the scarab. You're probably going to end up using up all of your rockets on the other vehicles, on the ghosts that are in this area. So there are a lot of choices in that area in terms of how you want to play it. But
and there's one also that you haven't touched on as well. I think it's easy to do it with a mongoose. You don't necessarily need to have a gun over. You can take a mongoose up the elevator to the top of the crane. Have you done this before?
Yeah. Oh, and yeah, and run off the end of it and drive the vehicle in. Yeah.
Somehow I don't know what it is, but driving vehicles under the scarab is the most epic experience ever.
So, you can get a warthog. You can get a warthog in there too. In fact, I actually drove a full warthog full of Marines into the there's a big chamber at the bottom of the thing. And what I was able to do is I just kind of drove around in the warthog full of rocket guys until they knocked off one of the legs, and the scarab then lowers gently, to the ground. If it lowers just right, you can actually jump off one of the ramps and land in the back, so you can drive into the scarab has at the bottom in the front has this big half circle area. You can drive the warthog in there. So I just drove them in there, and of course they don't get out of the vehicle, and then walked up inside the scarab to blow it up, and then I just left them there. And the real fun thing to do with that, of course, is that once you're done playing, is to go back and watch the film. You know, move the camera down into the position to see what happens to those Marines when the scarab blows. But yeah, you can do that with a mongoose. I mean, I like to do that even in Halo 2. I think that's the most fun you can have with the scarab encounter in Halo 2 is to drive the warthog right on top of it.
It's kind of too bad you can't
do anything else. Well, it's great though because once you get on there, it triggers another wave of enemies that come up the ramp. And if you've got a Marine gunner with you in the warthog, you can position it near the front of the scarab so that basically the Covenant can't see you, so they won't fire. but the Marine gunner can see them. And so they just kind of pour out of the middle of the thing and they mow them down. It's great. I think Bungie provided a lot of options for how to take down the Scarab. I think that's great. You know, you can drive a vehicle or you can be gunning. You can go and man one of the turrets. And I think if you're on like normal or easy, you can just man the turret. And if you don't remove it, it gets infinite ammo. You could just, you know, knock the heck out of the turret just standing in that position and get the Scarab that way.
Having said that, the Scarab does eventually turn around and blow you to smithereens.
Oh, true. But if you're on normal or easy, you can do enough damage to it before it does that. If you're on heroic or legendary, forget it. I mean, it won't work. I mean, actually, on legendary, if you try and man one of those turrets without removing it, the ghosts will just get you. Because the amount of damage they do with just a few shots is incredible. You'd just be standing there and it's like three or four shots.
The biggest headache of the level when it comes to legendary.
You've gotta pay attention to them first. And I would say in just about every one of these large sequences, especially where there's a Scarab involved, it's a good idea to take out all the other vehicles first, because they're actually bigger threats. And the Scarab's gun is really big and does damage to you, but dodging it is really pretty easy unless you're in a vehicle that you're not driving or you're in a fixed position like using a turret. The only problem with that, of course, is that even if you, say, get off the turret to dodge one of the Scarab shots, the Scarab shot's going to knock the turret off, so you don't get the infinite ammo again. Going back to the Mongoose, I can see why Bungie said, well, there's not a role for this vehicle in Halo 2, because it doesn't, you know, like, it's two passengers, so it's more than the Ghost, but less than the Warthog. It doesn't have its own gun. So basically, it's like if in this sequence, if you want to be involved with the Mongoose, you're gonna have to drive it, because riding it is simply not, it's simply not effective. And it's really, you're better off in terms of firepower bringing a troop hog there. So it feels kind of forced. You know, Bungie definitely wants you to have a certain kind of experience here. They want you to be driving a single Mongoose, and there's other Mongooses around, but at the higher difficulty levels, they don't last very long.
Scarab that gets there.
Yeah, a pelican comes in and will drop off some more for you, but they also don't seem to last long. You know, they're really prone to blowing themselves up. So I prefer to tackle that area with a troop hog full of rockets, because it gives you a lot more control. And that's obviously, I think, something that Bungie didn't anticipate or didn't really want you to have happen, because it's so difficult to get that. You know, you've got to individually get each of the Marines off of the Mongoose and into the troop hog. And I spent an awful lot of time getting to that point. You have to be careful not to kill too many Marines while you're doing it, because then they just turn on you. And, of course, they're all armed with rockets. So that doesn't work well.
Quick change of heart.
Yeah, so I actually managed to get a troop hog full. The mistake I made was I was doing it, I felt it would be safer to do it inside the door, right? So I've actually used the Warthog itself to block off the door to make sure that no matter what the Mongoose drivers do, they can't get out of that room. So I flip them over one by one, I get the rocket troops into the hog, and then I drive out through the door once it's full. And immediately as I drove out onto the dock, all the Marines got off of the troop hog and ran back to the Mongoose. So I had to do it all over. Basically, there was some checkpoint or some trigger volume that I went through there that reset their behaviors, and they all ran back to their original vehicles. Now, once I had triggered that, it was okay. I actually put the Warthog back in the position, blocking the door again, did the whole thing over, flipping over each of the Mongoose and getting the rocket guys into the hog, and then when I drove out, it was fine. They didn't do it again. But there was no way to know about that trigger before. So if you were just approaching that, it really looks like Bungie tried hard to make sure that the scenario happens the way they envisioned it, which is you're gonna drive a Mongoose and these other guys are gonna gun, and that's the experience they wanted you to have. So okay, so once that starts, I mean, if you just concede that and say, okay, fine, driving the Mongoose is fun. I mean, it's not as fast as a Warthog, but it is kind of, and it's less stable, but it's still fun to drive. It makes a fun noise. You know, it's pretty maneuverable. It certainly, if your complaint about the Warthog is that it turns too slowly, then the Mongoose will certainly help you out because it doesn't have that problem. It trades that off, though, for a little bit of stability. So I think they tried to make these vehicles behave differently. Otherwise, it's just a two-seat Warthog that doesn't have a gun. And I could see them saying, well, look, in Halo 2, what fun is a Warthog that only seats two and doesn't have a gun? So they just cut it. Here they put it in because people wanted it, but I think they also had a tough time finding a use for it. So they've created this very limited scenario that says, okay, fine, if we set this up this way, then there's a reason to have this vehicle. You know, if you have a lot of them and they can turn really quickly, but they flip more easily and they're not as fast, and then, okay, they don't have a gun, all right, but we'll give you one gunner and we'll make them be rockets. But it's kind of arbitrary because if you make any other kind of situation you want, it still works out better. I still think the Troop Hog is the most fun you can have in that area. But once you get out there, even if the Mongoose all end up dying, you know, there's still plenty of other ways to, you know, that you can handle that. As you mentioned, it, you know, you can go up that elevator and drive off the end of that, you know, that crane, you know, either on foot or you could do it in a Mongoose to get at the Scarab from the inside. You could just try to climb in. You can help the Mongoose guys try to knock it down by shooting one of the legs. You can go up into that area on the left with the turrets, and you can try to either pull off a turret and carry it with you, or you can try to use it in place. But again, like all the vehicle sequences, you know, the higher up the difficulty scale you go, the fewer your options are, because you're not going to have as some of those options are not as survivable. You know, if you say, okay, I'm going to take this thing out with a turret, and you get in the turret on Legendary, you know, you're going to die. Either a ghost is going to kill you, and if you pay too much attention to the other vehicles, you know, the Scarab's going to get you. And the missile launcher doesn't do as much damage, so, you know, it's like you can't just fire, like, one of those rockets at a ghost and say, okay, that's done. You know, it's going to take a couple of them. They're going to evade, or it'll just blow it over, and it'll land right side up, and it'll keep shooting at you. So if you want to play around with that sequence, like most of the vehicle sequences, you have to dial, you know, the difficulty back. I'd say that heroic really is legendary if you're doing that, and normal is the sweet spot where you can play around a lot and still have a good chance of surviving, you know, without dying or without dying too much.
I don't know. I mean, the Scarab as a single entity, ignoring all of the smaller vehicles around it, the actual Scarab itself is, I think you mentioned it before, it's just walking around chasing its own tail. It's got no real purpose.
Yeah, I think...
It's not really challenging. Once you know how to get rid of it, it's fairly easy to do on most difficulties. Having said that, Legendary is quite a challenge, but if you get yourself on top of it, you can usually just nearly avoid all the people on the Scarab, go around the back and make it explode, taking everyone on board with it.
The way the strengths and the weaknesses of the Scarab play out in Halo 3, I think, reminds me a lot of the Halo 1 Hunter. The Halo 1 Hunter, because of anything it does or any threat that it poses, but because of the way it looks and the way it acts, feels far more dangerous than it is. Most players, I think, figured out what the trick was. You know, you've got the pistol, one pistol shot to a vulnerable spot in the back. We'll take care of the Hunter, and sidestepping the melee attack, because it only attacks in one direction from the front, is really pretty easy. And even if you didn't know that already, you know, even if you hadn't played the game already, or if you hadn't read on the internet that you could do this, one of the promotional movies that plays while you let the game idle shows you somebody from Bungie performing that sequence. So if you just pop Halo 1 into your player for a while and don't touch it, eventually you'll see a movie where a guy very calmly and very coolly takes out a Hunter in exactly that manner. So it would show you. And of course they changed that. I mean, for Halo 2, they changed, you know, the way the Hunters look. They made it so that they have a backwards swipe to their melee. So for instance, you can't just stand in front of it, wait for it to swipe you, and then kind of get around the back, because he's going to turn around, he's going to hit you with that shield from the back. The pistol is gone, and single shots from a BR or a sniper rifle won't kill it. You need to get more than one shot. So in Halo 2 and Halo 3, hunters are more dangerous and more difficult to take out than they are in Halo 1. But because of that, I always tend to take care of them from a distance or from heavy weapons. I think Bungie always imagined that a hunter would be something you'd want to fight with a rocket launcher. I mean, they even set that up in Silent Cartographer when this Pelican crashes and Cortana says, "Well, once I saw we were up against Hunter, I wanted some heavy weapons, and so here's the rocket launcher." But that's not the best way to take out a Hunter in Halo 1. It's not even the most fun way. But I would say that because the Hunters are actually more dangerous, they feel less dangerous. There's no reason to get as close to a Hunter in Halo 2 or Halo 3 as there is in Halo 1. And I think that's where the drama came from. The drama came from, wow, I'm gonna let this big, dangerous-looking thing bear right down on me, and then at the last moment, I'm going to sidestep and shoot it in the back. And, you know, that's, to me anyway, that's fun no matter how many times you do it. But you get to Halo 2, and the first time you see Hunters in Halo 2, you know, the best way to take it out is with the, you know, is with the turret. So you're a long ways away from them. You know, you just hold the trigger until they die. And sure, they're more dangerous. You know, if you don't keep the gun on them, you know, if you don't fire at them, their weapons are more dangerous. And if you get closer to them, they're far more dangerous. But because you can't take them out with that one shot in the back, there's no reason to ever get that close. You know, unless you run out of ammunition, you don't have any guns for any other weapons, maybe you have to come right up to them and hit them with a grenade or something. Melee is obviously not really all that effective. So the Scarab...
Well, having said that, the melee is much more... Well, I think it's more effective in Halo 3 than it was in both Halo 1 and Halo 2. In Halo 2, even with the sword, meleeing was completely useless. It didn't do any damage. But in Halo 3... if you beat the back of a hunter enough, it actually fractures their armor.
Yeah. So the Scarab, I think, is a little bit like that. I mean, obviously, for instance, they've put more armament on the thing. I mean, the Scarab in Halo 2, in and of itself, was not dangerous at all. I mean, it didn't have weapons that it used against you. It was just a troop carrier, and the danger to you was the troops that it carried. And you blew it up from inside, but you never saw how. So I would say that, you know, of all the elements of Halo 3, the Scarab is one of the areas where I think they very clearly, either they already had an internal list of things they wanted to do differently, or else they took one of the many fan-compiled lists. You know, there were people who said that, you know, what is this? You just walk into the thing, and then it blows up. How did it blow up? How did you blow it up? Why did you blow it up? And they've given us all that. You know, they put the big gun on the top of the thing. They made it move around. It'll now attack you. But I think some of the problem is that, like a lot of the AI doesn't live long enough to demonstrate all of its behaviors unless you're at a high difficulty level. You know, unless the damage model is really in the creature's advantage. So, for instance, you play on normal on easy, you know, you can blow that thing up before it has a chance to be interesting. But on Legendary, your options for taking it out are limited. I would say that, you know, on Legendary especially, the quicker you approach this thing and get on board, the better a chance you have. Because you're much better off being on the thing where it can't shoot you with its turret, you know, either one of them, the one on the top or the main one. You're much better off just fighting whatever is on there. And once you get on there, you know, there are a couple of turrets on the side that you can use to mow down any enemy in your way, and then you can actually use on the power core to blow it up. So, again, your options are kind of narrowed at the high difficulty. So the problem is that at the low difficulty, it's not much of a threat. At the high difficulties, though, there's clearly one best way to take it out, and trying to do different things to have, you know, just to have a different experience gets to be frustrating because, you know, if you're going to try and drive a mongoose around and wait until those rocket guys, you know, blow a leg and then blow the back cover so that you can shoot the actual power core from the outside, you know, without going on board, you know, you could be at that for a while. And, of course, you know, Mongoose not being as stable as it is, the more you drive around, the more likely is you're going to fall off the cliff or get blown up.
All right, we're going to give you listeners a bit of a break from all of our yapping and chatting. We're going to throw on some Halo 3 music, This Is Our Land. As you heard at the start, I'm sure, I hope all of you recognized it. We'll be back shortly. So, moving on now, I think to, and although it's not mentioned here in our notes, anger, sadness, and envy this week. Have you thought much on that?
I don't want to repeat myself, but I guess the bit that made me angry is that Mongoose encounter. So it's almost the same thing again. It's difficult to fathom somehow why the Marines are set up the way they are in terms of vehicle preference. It appears that it's not just as simple as Marines will get into any vehicle you're driving, no matter what it is, where it came from, or where you are, that they've obviously got some priorities. Those Marines would obviously prefer to be on a Mongoose, and they will only get in other things when you take away all of their options. I would prefer to have it set up so that they would take their lead from the Master Chief. So if the Master Chief ignores the Mongoose and brings a Warthog with him, I would say that, you know, they should get off those other vehicles and get in the one I'm driving. And if there's leftover guys after that, let them get on Mongoose. So I guess that it really ticked me off that there seemed to be so many barriers put into the way of manipulating that scenario the way I wanted. I could see that, yeah, okay, if you're playing on normal, a troop hog full of rockets makes things perhaps too easy. But on legendary, I think it's entirely fair. I think you ought to be able to do that. So that's really what made me angry when I was playing that level.
I think for me, my anger topic is probably comfortably the ghosts in the first encounter, the first open sky encounter. Just the sheer number of them and the fact that wherever you really go, unless you stay where you started, which doesn't have the appropriate weaponry, unless you stay where you started, you're not going to get attacked. Everywhere else you do, you can't go on the ground. You'll have two or three of them. The best vantage point I found, I think, on Legendary was actually going right up to the cliff, and there's a little sort of a smaller cliff on the outside of it. When ghosts try and fly at you with that, they just fly themselves off the cliff.
Yeah.
You don't actually kill them,
and that...
they kill themselves. And so that was frustrating, just having to do that encounter probably.
Yeah, and there are a lot of similarities. If you think about it, this whole geographical area that starts with Savo Highway and ends with these three outdoor areas are all of these areas where you have a sheer drop on your right hand side as you proceed, you know, from the beginning to the end of the level, and yeah, the AI vehicles don't handle that very well. It's very easy in those areas to kind of hang around near the cliff edge and get them to rush at you while you're behind the cover of some rock and get them to drive right off the cliff. Now, of course, the Marines also will do it, so you have to be careful if you decide that you want to ride in any vehicle. I find that sometimes the ghost will just, you know, fall off a cliff not doing anything to them at all. I mean, sometimes they'll just do it. Why don't we do sadness first? Because I've got a sadness. I'm not sure if I've got an envy. I'll have to think of one quickly. But I would say sadness is the very next bit after you've defeated the Scarab. You go into the second and larger outdoor area, And that door has an invisible barrier on it to prevent you from bringing vehicles in. So, for instance, there's a lot of small vehicles in that area that would fit in there. There's ghosts that if you get them sideways, that they'll go through the door, and a mongoose can actually drive right in. But there's an elastic barrier that prevents you from driving through that area. Now, you can get out of the vehicle, and you can melee bash it through, and once you're past that barrier, you can get in. But if you get in a vehicle, or if you have a vehicle with you, when you advance far enough down that hallway that triggers the Cortana moment and closes the door behind you, just like we've noticed in a lot of these other areas where they will close off so you can't backtrack. When you trigger that Cortana moment, the door locks behind you, and any vehicle that you brought with you into that area disappears. Even if you're in it, it'll disappear from out from under you. And that really made me sad. I mean, I understand that Bungie wants to control, you know, within a certain range, the circumstances of the way you play the encounters. They probably don't want you taking a Warthog loaded with rocket launcher wielding Marines into this interior area. One, it'd probably be really dangerous because, you know, even more so than the outdoor areas, the Marines would end up blowing themselves up. And if they don't, then you're going to take down those troops that are in there really, really quickly. Or, you know, if you could bring a mongoose in, you could just drive right through, right? I mean, there's only a couple doors you have to open. You could just drive right through the whole sequence and ignore anything. But to a certain extent, I wonder why they do that. I mean, yeah, sure, some players are going to do that. I just think it adds replay value. I don't know that there's really a danger that, you know, new players, I mean, I suppose it is. Some people did say that, oh, Halo 3 is too short. And say that, well, stop playing on normal. I still kind of like some of the glitches in Halo 1 where, you know, if you hijack a Banshee before you're supposed to, you know, the enemies stop spawning and you can just drive all the way to the end. I mean, I think that's kind of neat. I could see Bungie fixing it so that, you know, you can't ever stop enemies from spawning. But if I want to take a vehicle where I'm not supposed to take a vehicle or where I'm not expected to take a vehicle, I'd prefer that they just left it alone. I mean, you know, sometimes it'll be more fun, sometimes it'll be less. That kind of saddened me. You know, I went to all this effort to get a vehicle into that area, and then, you know, poof, they just made it disappear. And I thought that was really kind of unfair and arbitrary. You know, I realized that they anticipated that. You know, they wanted to stop people from doing that, but that just kind of made me sad.
All right. You mentioned just briefly then the Cortana moment. What I'm going to do is for the people who haven't familiarized themselves with the Cortana moments in this level, I'm just going to play through each of them.
I have defied gods and demons. I am your shield. I am your sword. This is the way the world ends.
I actually thought from the announcement trailer that those quotes were actually going somewhere. Obviously, this is the way the world ends, you know, is the T.S. Eliot quote from The Hollow Men, and was used in the Cortana letters from years and years ago. But even beyond that, you know, this reference, the shield and sword reference, I mean, of course, Cortana, just like Durandal from Marathon, you know, they're taking the names of fictional and mythical swords from various legends. So we understand how, you know, the AI character that accompanies you through the game is often looked upon as a sword, as a, you know, it makes sense. It's a tool or a weapon. I thought the sword and shield reference, though, that they were hinting a little bit at talking about how the Halo installations work in terms of, you know, a Halo installation being a sword world and, you know, a construct with offensive capability, and that there were also shield worlds that had primarily defensive capabilities like
Onyx.
Like Onyx. And I was one of the people who, before the game came out, you know, thought that Earth was also a shield world. Now, it doesn't seem that it's turned out that way, and there's no other mention of shield worlds or any other mention of Onyx within the context of the game. So I kind of felt that kind of dropped. I mean, it didn't really go with anywhere. Most of what is said by Cortana, the Cortana moments, doesn't really advance the story or even hint at anything much. In fact, it's not until you get the Gravemind moments that that you start to get bits of story in those. Other than that, I think it's really just atmosphere.
All right, my my sadness this week would probably be the simplicity in which you take down a scarab. Essentially, you have to destroy one particular area of the scarab, and it would be nice if it could collapse just under the damage you've done to it, just because of structural damage as well. But being that it just falls down and then gets back up and walks around again, it doesn't seem too realistic. I mean, what happens when it has to stop and, what is it, like, crouch down in the middle? There's no sort of actual happenings while this goes on. You're expected to hop on and blow it up before it gets back up or something. I'm not too sure. But I'm a fan of realism, and I just think there could have been a little bit more put into that, more options explored.
Well, I can see it. For instance, if they had put an on-screen damage meter on there, the way a lot of games do with their boss enemies, you know, to tell you exactly how far you are away from killing this character, then I think I really would have objected. I can understand what you're saying, that you know, you shouldn't necessarily have to blow up this one vulnerable spot. And there are certainly other boss battles that, you know, that are annoying that way. For instance, I think there's, in Doom 3, I think about two-thirds of the way through, there's also a massive walking tank thing that looks, you know, very much like a scarab. And it basically has one vulnerable spot. And if you know, any damage that is not directed at that spot at a specific time is wasted. It doesn't have any effect at all. I think Bungie did actually a nice compromise here. That doesn't mean I wouldn't change anything about it, but I do like the fact that, for instance, you can damage the turret, and that the one on the top, and that does seem to affect the rate at which it fires, but you can't destroy it entirely. And that I dislike. I would have liked the ability to blow that completely off so that I didn't have to worry about it.
You can do substantial damage to the main cannon too.
Does it have any practical effect? I mean, it doesn't stop it from operating.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah, see, so, you know, I could see maybe that they leave that alone, but with the turret on top.
Much like the damaged vehicles as well. When you've got a damaged vehicle, it has no actual effect on the vehicle itself. You can have a barely functioning ghost and it'll run just as fast as a brand new one. And that's something I wanted to see in Halo 3, which didn't, and I can understand the complexity of that and the balancing issues that have in multiplayer for damaged vehicles.
Well, they could have just left that out.
Setting options and whatnot.
I don't think they need to consider that when it comes to multiplayer, because multiplayer has got a whole other set of controls that they can tweak. And for instance, if you want to play multiplayer with indestructible vehicles, you can. So if they had made vehicle damage affect vehicle performance, they could also have toggled that as an option. So they could have said, okay, we're going to put that in a campaign and either leave it out of multiplayer or make it a multiplayer option. The thing I see about that, though, is that I think that the vehicle being damaged, given that it will damage you when it's destroyed, so the advantage that a fresh vehicle has is not that it performs at 100%, but how far it is away from damaging you, you know, when it's blown up. Obviously, you want to prefer an undamaged vehicle if you can find one. So I didn't think it was really necessary for them to, say, make a damaged Warthog go more slowly. I think that just would be frustrating, and that would basically mean nobody would want to drive any vehicle that wasn't 100%. So if there was a change, I think, that I would make to the Scarab, it's not that I would get rid of the vulnerable spot. As a mechanic, I think that's okay. I think if the main way of attacking the Scarab was just cumulative damage, then that might be a little bit less interesting. And it also means that there'd basically be no incentive to board it. You know, if you could take...
Oh, no, I think you might misunderstand. What I mean is, like, you'd have the primary way of destroying the Scarab. There'd be, a critical structural damage if you literally blew off two or three of the legs and permanently damaged, really messed with the front cannon. then it becomes sort of unuseful and it shuts down and everyone gets off. I mean, but for that to happen, it's got to be substantially more damage than any sort of damage to make it sit down so you mm-hmm. can get on board, or it should be easier to destroy it with that simple
yeah.
way, it, the same way we do it now, but just to have the effect of blowing off a leg actually doing something rather than not doing
yeah,
anything.
Yeah, I think
would be...
That I would I would agree with. I understand what Bungie was trying to do with that that idea, but I think I would have preferred to say that, okay, if you blow off one leg, then temporarily disable it and then let it get back up. If you do two or three, though, I really think that the thing should just fall down and stay down. But instead, yeah. it's like all the damage you're doing to the legs is either self-reparable or and it's not real damage. So as you're right, it's like you're kind of forced into, okay, you knock it down, and on Legendary, you want to then take it down as quickly as you can. You don't want to let it get, you know, you don't want to let it get back up. But I could see that, yeah, it maybe would have been better if, you know, the attacking the power core was a way of taking it down quickly, whereas you could, say, just blow all the legs off and let it sit, or, you know, you could just, you know, circle around it and constantly damage every part of it until it blows up, but it would take a lot longer. Still, I mean, you know, they did an awful lot of change, you know, in the Scarab from Halo 2 to Halo 3, and I still find that those fights are a lot of fun. I just think, like, a lot of the vehicle components, you know, when something interesting happens, it's a lot more fun than some of the purely infantry-based encounters. But there are plenty of times where, you know, something interesting doesn't happen. I mean, there are times I've played that on, say, Heroic or Normal when, you know, the Scarab will really roam around quite a bit and will chase you or chase Marines, and there'll be some interesting things to look at and interesting things to happen. And then there are just some other times where, you know, if you get very close to it and you circle around because, you know, say you've got a turret or something and you're trying to attack the back of it from the outside instead of a leg, then all it does is try to constantly turn around to aim the turret at you, and you just kind of circle strafe around the thing, and it can never get the gun on you, and, you know... Again, it's just luck. With the vehicles, there's just a much wider range of things that can happen, and some of them are less interesting than average, and some of them are a lot more interesting. And you just get a more chance to see some of those if you dial the difficulty back a little bit.
All right. Have you been able to conjure a Envy for this week?
Since you mentioned Assassin's Creed, I would just say that there's part of me that somehow wanted there to be a stealth element in the game. So I would say that the removal of the active camo, even as an option, rather than taking it away from the Arbiter in order to make the Chief and the Arbiter equal in the game, I would have preferred that they had kept that. I did have some fun in Halo 2 in parts of the level using the active camo. So I would have thought it was neat if, you know, if they had a little cutscene that said that, you know, as a side benefit of the alliance with the elites, that the Chief, at least because of his suit and the built-in shields, that he would get active camo. Okay, don't give it to Marines, you know, don't get too complicated. But I think it would have been useful. I mean, it would have been another way of attacking a Scarab, right? I mean, you go invisible and then jump on board it, sneak by everybody, and then blow it up. I mean, that would have been fun. So, you know, I would have preferred to have that option in and rather than see it removed.
All right, and finally, for myself, I think the Envy would probably be, like, as I said before, I've been playing a bit of Assassin's Creed. The way in which the assassin moves, I really, really like the movement style of that game. I wish that, even if it was just for saved films, that the Master Chief could have the same sort of
mobility. Now, how does that work? I haven't played it, obviously, but I've read that it maps a part of your body to each of the controls so that you're not, like, you're not pushing a button to do a specific thing, but you push a context-sensitive button, you know, for a body part, and then the character does something with that body part, whatever is appropriate for where he's standing. Is that the way it works?
That's not quite the understanding that I had. What I'm sort of referring to is that when you move, like, forward and back in Halo 3, the Master Chief's body is like in a central location. It doesn't move with the environment, sort of thing. It's and when you shoot, for example, you're holding that rifle up. It is extremely stationary. You've got the reticle in a single spot. Right. Doesn't move when you move. However, in Assassin's Creed, when you move around, it's a little bit different because you're not using projectile weaponry, generally speaking. It looks like he actually is running when he runs, whereas in Halo, it just looks sort of funny. If you compare running or sprinting in Halo to the TV spot that we had, it was the CG rated one that introduced the bubble shield. The way he ran in that was perfect. That's how I would envision the Chief to run, not how he runs in the game. And I've always sort of thought that even from the very first Halo, I mean, I understand that it's a little bit graphically hard to do, but actually seeing a game do it now and then seeing a game that I adore, such as Halo, not having that that really, really cool movement, it's sort of disappointing. Even the Marines in all the way back in Sierra 117, when they get up to like a log, they'll climb over it rather than jump over it. The jumping is unrealistic in Halo. Never really grasped how the Chief could suddenly jump so far up in the sky without crouching. But that's my envy for the week.
Okay. A couple other quick things. We talked about Hunters already a bit, so we won't go into that too much. But this is, of course, the first time in Halo 3 that you see Hunters, and it solidifies this idea that, you know some, I wrote a lot about Halo 3 came out about how they were going to balance out the different enemy units, because we had some Hunters on our side, you know, in Halo 2, and there were times when you'd have various enemy units allied with you. In Halo 3, of course, the only ones who are allied with you are the elites. Everybody else is an enemy, including the Hunters. And so when this next indoor area inside the storm ends and you go out through the door to advance on the AA gun, that's the first time you see Hunters. And it's also the first time you see another thing, because the Hunters are attacking civilians there. It was kind of strange in Halo 2 that you land in New Mombasa, and although it has been attacked by the Covenant, it's also completely empty. I mean, there are no human civilians there, not even any bodies. It's been completely abandoned. And so here we're out in the middle of the savannah when we start Savo Highway, and we advance toward a small town. It seems like this town of Voi, if that's where we are, is kind of dominated by this factory owned by this company, Traxxas. But there are still people here who aren't soldiers. And so there are all of these construction workers with their uniforms and their yellow hard hats who have armed themselves and are being attacked by Hunters. And so I thought that was kind of a nice touch. And it also, if you play again at a low difficulty level, it gives you a chance to have a lot of fun, because the way the damage model works, if you're playing, I think, on easy or normal, even the construction workers that get hit by the Hunters' weapons don't die. If you take out those Hunters quickly enough, and there are several turrets in that area, so taking the Hunters out, again, just like in Halo 2, they give you turrets to fight the Hunters. If you take those out quickly enough, you can actually have a fairly large group of troops with you. You can have about like almost a dozen construction workers and a half dozen Marines. And on the low difficulty levels, you can go through that next outdoor area all the way to the anti-aircraft gun, where I had a lot of fun because the AI obviously has that AA gun listed as a target, but it's also a special item. It's going to end the level when you blow that up. So even after the speech triggers that tell you what you're supposed to do in that level have played, the AI will not by itself attack that AA gun. But if you fire, they will fire. So you can have a really funny sequence where, you know, I was firing, say, a needler at the thing because I didn't want to really damage it. I just wanted to fire. If you just fire a couple of rounds at this thing, all of these construction workers with their pistols will fire a single shot in unison at the AA gun. Which I just thought was hilarious, actually. I actually took some screenshots of that because and when it finally blows and the cutscene plays, this is one of the few cutscenes in Halo 3 that you can actually influence the objects that are, you know, that are in the background. So, for instance,
I observed that yesterday with a leftover regenerator that was still on when the cutscene played.
Yeah, yeah. So, for instance, the couple of times I've brought this massive group of construction workers, they will set themselves all up on the top of the hill at the back of that area, aiming towards the gun. And so they're still there when the cutscene plays, and you can see them walking around on the hill in their little hard hats in the background, while the chief and the arbiter are in the foreground. I guess the only other thing to say is that, as we mentioned before, that this cutscene that ends this level is really where the story kind of starts. We find out what Truth was after. It becomes apparent that whatever this thing is buried on Earth is not the Ark. It's something else. It opens up this portal, and then all the ships go through it. The only thing I thought was really odd about this is that this is one cutscene where the absence of Cortana is really acutely felt. Because after this is triggered and the Covenant ships go through it, you know, Lord Hood says, well, what did Truth do? Did he activate the rings? And Commander Key says no. I wanted to know at that moment, how did she know that it wasn't? You know, how did she have any idea what Truth had or hadn't done? I mean, for all she knew, that installation was the Ark, and Truth did. You know, it turns out it's not, but she doesn't really have any way of knowing that at that point. You might believe that Cortana might know, you know, having been in the computer systems of High Charity and having been in the computer systems of Installation 04, that she might know and could explain to the player exactly what has happened. What is this thing that Truth has found, and what is this object that he has activated? Aha, that this is a portal that goes somewhere. And of course, you know, at the end of the next level, Cortana does show up to explain that to you. But they've got Keys right here saying, no, Truth didn't activate the rings. And I was going to wonder, well, how does she know that? You know, she's only ever seen one of them before. She can't possibly know how these things work.
Well, they're alive.
Well, they're alive, but again, I mean, at the end of the game, when the Halo is triggered, I mean, you've got a lot more time than I thought you'd have, you know, to escape. So,
yeah.
You know, the fact that you're alive at the moment, and then even if you consider if the Halos have a pulse that travels at the speed of light, it still wouldn't be instantaneous. We don't even know for sure how far Earth is away from the nearest installation, so how long it would be before the effects were noticed.
Yeah.
But anyway, all right. Yeah, it's the first significant bit of story you get. And, you know, despite all the nitpicks, I mean, I do like the Halo 3 Scarabs. I like it. They're a lot more fun than the one Scarab that's in Halo 2. And this is a fun level. I mean, this is a level that I do replay quite a bit. Really, Savo and Highway and this one are kind of bookended. I like to play with vehicles. I mean, and as finicky as it is, you know, as difficult as it is sometimes to get Marines to do what you want, and as difficult as it is sometimes to have an experience that is challenging but not being frustrating, I still do really feel that it's Halo's ambition in that area that sets it apart from other games that are just corridor crawlers.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think at that we'll leave it for this week. I think we've covered, I think, all aspects of the storm, I hope.
Yep.
And next time we do a podcast, I'm not going to say next week because it might not be next week. It could be in four or five days. It could be
probably
in
2 weeks. Won't be next week. Yeah.
But next time we do a podcast, it's going to be on Floodgate. It's probably going to be reasonably shorter than the normal ones because Floodgate is actually a really, really short level.
True, but there is that cutscene at the end, so there's actually a lot of story to talk about there.
All right, then. We'll leave it at that. We'll see you all next time.
Okay.